I've already said, please make it fast. Well, I mean, I have to be honest, my seat is reserved. My grandson's allowed me to sit in the middle of the sofa. All right then, let's make a start. So, good evening to you all. It's been a sort of a nice day the rest of the afternoon. But personally, I've been running around doing my granddad's duties, so I didn't see much of it. Right, we'll start off with the minutes of the 8th of February, as published in the Digest. Okay. We don't need to. Do we need to have them agreed?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Would you please agree that they?
Aye.
Okay, then. Apologies.
Yes, thank you. We've got apologies tonight from Councillor Marnie Phillips, who's substituted this evening by Councillor Peter Jones, and from Councillor Jenny Barron, who's substituted by Councillor Ray Barron.
Yeah. I did ask earlier, how's Mrs. Barron then?
She's okay.
She's all right.
Jack, yeah, she's still got a...
Yeah.
I think the results of that cycle hitting her in the town.
Okay.
She's never been right, so she's... Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. And I did ask earlier today about my, I can't never pronounce her name, Councillor Phillips.
Marnie,
that's it. I did ask, and I was told she's okay. That was the best information we had, wasn't it, Andrew?
I think it was, unless anyone said anything.
I spoke to Councillor Price, Chairman, earlier today, and she's just feeling ill with the problems she has that she goes for these infusions.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for that. Right. We move then to good evening. I wish you always make me smile when you come in, so I can always say hello. Right. Okay then. We're on to number three now, Mike. Public question time.
That's nil.
Council session.
That's nil.
Members item.
They're nil.
Called in item.
And there are none.
And we now move to the officer's report, 7A, which is the quarter performance reporting, and Karen is going to do the honours.
Thank you, Chair.
And I think you'll have to shout at some of these.
I'll do my best.
Okay.
I can't see some of you from behind the screen. That's me.
Right.
Sorry. Okay, thank you, Chair. So in front of you, you've got a report that summarises quarter four performance from the year 2020 to 2021. So essentially performance between January and March this year. I think just a couple of notes that I want to draw to your attention in terms of the context within which these performance reports were compiled. As you're more than aware, the last quarter of last year was very challenging for all of us. We were in the third national lockdown, and as officers, as well as providing our sort of business usual services, we were also providing a whole range of COVID support services. And I think that the performance reporting, both in terms of the data we have or haven't been able to gather, and some of the performance issues do reflect that. However, we are on track for the majority of the indicators during that time. So section 5, as we move on to page 4, just gives you a little bit more flavour for some of the issues and challenges that we were dealing with during the lockdown. At 5.2, you can see that whilst we were grappling with all of the response, sort of demand for our services remained high. We've highlighted here land charges and development management services. But I'm aware this was a picture that was consistent across the council, across the authority, and has been during the pandemic, that actually our demand for services has actually increased during this period of time. Paragraph 5.3, you'll be aware that across the authority, we were undertaking lots of different additional duties. So from an economic growth perspective, one of the biggest areas of work that we've done is in terms of managing the business grants. And providing direct funding to those businesses affected. We've got Martine here tonight who, if the committee wish to at some point, can give us a little bit of an update on the work that we've done around business grants and how many we've handed out and to whom and so on and so forth. Perhaps we could come to that after I've finished the body report. We've also done quite a lot of work in terms of our Beautiful Warrior campaign. Again, I'm not going to take any credit for that. My team can answer any questions on that as well. It's her team that has led that. So I think in the context of this report, I think it's just bearing that in mind in terms of as we then go through the narrative updates on each of the performance areas.
Right. Okay, then we'll start on page 3. Anybody got any questions to ask on page 3? No? Over the page to 4, page 4.
Yes, Chair.
You have to shout at the others, right?
Thank you. With regard to 5.3, I appreciate that you may not be able to name individuals, but can you advise us what sort of businesses have been, the money's been distributed to?
Of course we have. Thank you.
Would you like to bring your chair to
bring your chair to the table?
To the table.
Okay.
Now.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
It's a pleasure.
So it's been over a year now since the first lockdown grants, which were March of last year. To date, as of Friday last week, we've paid out $47,687,000 in business grants. The mandatory grants, which are the ones that governments stipulate we have to pay to people that are in rateable value properties and within certain sectors such as hospitality, retail and leisure, they totaled up to sort of 25 million last year, and then this year we paid a further 21 million, and that's a combination of grants. So that would be people that have been given the lockdown payments because they were mandated to close from the 5th of November up until the end of April. And within that, we've also paid those businesses that are not in rateable value premises. So in other words, government dictate to us how much and who we pay depending on what the rateable value of the premises are. And we realise that, you know, there's a huge gap of people who wouldn't be paid because they share space. So we can take an example, maybe up at Beacon Park, there's an office block there, and people don't actually pay the rates directly, but they pay on a lease. Well, they wouldn't have been able to claim any grants, so we've written into our policy that if the business is based in Stafford and they're not a rate payer, and they can demonstrate they've lost 30% of income, then we will pay them pro rata. We didn't think it was fair for the ARG policy, as I call it, the assisted restriction grant policy, to exactly mirror the same payments to those that are in rateable value premises, because the overheads are significantly less. So typically in a shared office space, you wouldn't have to pay, you know, obviously rent and rates and huge utility bills. So we sort of put forward with Councillor Beattie and Councillor Smith agreements as to what the amount should be for those type of businesses. So if your business isn't in a rateable value premise, if you're a market trader, taxi driver, a driving instructor, you share office space, or even we've got some cases of businesses, for example in Stone, where there's a hairdresser who pays rates on the building and she's got a grant, but she leases out a chair to a lady that does nails, so we've been able to pay the lady that does the nails as well. So the final phase at the moment this week, and I'm really pleased with the way that we're going, is over the year, and this isn't businesses, because some businesses have had multiple grants, like for the lockdown, the wet leg cloth grant, and another payment, but we've actually sort of processed 10,635 grant applications spread across a broad range, and we've now finally, this as of today, whittled it down to just 80 applications that are outstanding. So the applications that we've got at the moment are those self-employed. So these are people that are working from home. It's slightly more difficult with the self-employed because unlike a limited company, they don't have to file accounts, so we're very much based on their UTR tax returns. Mm-hmm. And obviously we have to make sure that they can demonstrate they've made a loss of 30%. So we're dealing with a lot of confidential personal accounts. So we're treating these applications with the same confidentiality as we do with all the others, but a bit more of a kid glove treatment, because
we're talking to a very vulnerable audience, that, you know, hairdressers that probably have not been able to work, or driving instructors, it's been their only source of income. And because their income has been fairly low, they've not been able to access the self-employed income support scheme, which is the government scheme. So we've had some really terrible cases, really, where we've ended up almost being an ear to these businesses to say, look, we understand, give us the evidence, and we'll make sure that if you're eligible, we'll get a payment back to you as quick as we can. So we're actually just down to 80 at the moment. To give you an idea, we have 320 self-employed applications in. We probably have had about 500 people phone, email, and we've reduced it down to 300 that we consider would have the right sort of evidence. If you compare that to Canada, they've had 100 self-employed grant applications, so three times more than Stafford. And I think that's down to the fact that we've got a very good entrepreneurial base in the borough. We've got a lot of good start-up businesses. But we've also got businesses that have started and they've also survived. So we measure survival rates by businesses that keep trading 3 years. And compared to other areas of the county, and indeed the West Midlands, our survival rates are pretty good. So I think we've had a lot of inquiries because we have got those entrepreneurs in the borough. And we've been able to help them out with the grants that we've got. So I was actually thinking today, you know, who haven't we paid? You know, if somebody said to me, here's £1 million, go out and pay. I can't think of a sector that we haven't paid.
Can I ask how they know about it?
Well, we've got a very good comms team, so we'll put out lots of press releases. The Our Beautiful World campaign that Karen mentioned, that has sort of brought all the retails together from the three towns. So we've got a big database now of the retailers, hospitality and leisure businesses, so we've been emailing them regularly. We've got good social media hits, so I push things out on my LinkedIn, so I've got quite a good following on that, and then my contacts push theirs out, Karen pushes out via her LinkedIn. And also it's word of mouth, so working with the Town Centre Partnership, Stone Traders Group, the people in Eccleshaw, you know, they've been very, very supportive of us in making sure that their contacts are aware of what's available. And a lot of it's word of mouth with self-employed people as well. So, you know, within the council alone, I'll drop an email and say, look, if you've got friends, family, relatives, whatever, are self-employed, please ask them to get in touch with us. So I think we've done quite a good job of getting the message out there, and I think it's reflected by the number of applications that we've had. And as I say, final applications finish on the 30th of June, so we've got 80 left that we're working on now, and then they're sort of just trickling in. But I think by that period, we would have maybe covered the whole of the borough, really. The only ones I can think that haven't been paid are the bigger manufacturing-type companies that were not mandated to close. But having said that, we did write into our policy that if a manufacturer is a provider to a business that's been mandated to close, or a sector, we will pay them. So we've been able to support quite a few what I call mom-and-pop companies in the borough. So we've got one lady who manufactures, you know, tablecloths, high-end tablecloths for hotels. Well, her business didn't have to close, but her sector closed. So we've been able to cover the suppliers of goods and services to those as well. So I think, as I say, it's not much that we haven't really covered. It'd be interesting to see at the end of probably July when we paid everybody what the final figures will be.
Oh, thank you. You want to come back, Alison?
No, thank you.
Francis, you wanted to speak.
I just wanted to add to what Martine said in terms of the database. We started some really solid work before the coronavirus on building a database of businesses, which really wasn't that complete. We knew the ones that were paying council tax and so on, but there were numbers and numbers of small businesses, micro businesses, that we didn't know about, including those that are in the rural areas. And I think that's paid enormous dividends. And I think it's fair to say that Martine is on a mission now to maintain that database and to keep updating it. And she's working with Rob Wolf on making sure that that happens. I don't know if you want to add to that, Martine, but that makes a massive difference to the way that the borough council can support all businesses across the borough, and that's everything, including our tourism businesses that She hasn't specifically mentioned, but we're also giving great attention to her.
Oh, thank you. Do you want to add anything to that, Martine?
Thank you. Just to confirm, what I think has been really good is the fact that government have allowed local authorities to take control of part of funding and make it allow us to tailor that fund to suit our business makeup, because the business makeup of Stafford Borough is totally different to the business makeup, say, of Stoke or Wolverhampton or Rugby. So for us being able to write our own policy to suit our businesses, I think has been a real eye-opener for me. And also what it's enabled us to do is actually develop the relationship with businesses that we didn't know before, and they didn't know about us before. So the whole business engagement team, which is my team now, have got, you know, been in touch with many, many businesses two or three times, and we've developed that relationship. And as Councillor Beattie says, we can take it forward now and make sure these businesses grow and we develop them. So it's been an added bonus us managing the grants within Karen's team, because it's given us that bonding with the businesses. And actually, we've now become the first port of call for business advice, whereas before people probably thought, you know, only residents will phone the council, you know, to ask for advice on different things. Now what we're finding from the contact centre is an awful lot of businesses phone us first to ask for advice on funding and grants and planning and relocation. So it's really set us apart. There's not been too many local authorities that I'm aware of that have got a business engagement team that we have, that are specifically focused on working with the businesses in the region. And I think that sets us apart. I think it's all looking good for the future from the reports that I'm reading.
Right, thank you. Now, I've got Mark. Do you want to come back, Dean?
Just for actually clarity about the £750 payment for taxi drivers, how does that come about? Was it a government directed, or was it something that you...
Not really. With the assisted restriction grant, which is a separate pot of money that we were given based on the number of residents in the borough, we were permitted to write our own policy, but we had suggestions from government that they would like to see market traders and shared space and B&Bs that were not rental value B&Bs included. And then we were sort of given license to write our policies. So I did a bit of research and I looked at who else was working in the taxi driver arena, and we came up with a figure of 750, which was sort of a midway figure. So Warrington and Newcastle, I think, paid £250 a taxi driver, and Stoke paid £1,000. So we sort of pitched ourselves in the middle. And I think from working with the licensing team, we've obviously seen that we had 220 taxi driver applications.
Right.
On top of that, those taxi drivers, because it was a one-off payment, they can also apply for self-employed grants. So we've had a couple that have had two lots of funding.
Right, I've got Mark first.
Yeah. Well, can I just have a supplementary on that?
Okay. Oh, go on then.
Over what period was that 750 covering?
It was just a one-off payment.
Yeah, to cover how? What period of time?
Well, we introduced the policy. I think it was the last but one policy, so that would have been around March time.
March 2021.
Yeah. Because prior to that, we didn't have sort of a discretionary pot to allocate to businesses. We were dictated to by government who could pay, whereas with a discretionary pot, we could decide.
And have you got a feeling for how long it was supposed to last?
Well, when they announced the discretionary, do you mean the actual payment to the taxi drivers or
the
account?
No, taxi driver.
I'm not really aware. I mean, Robert, I'm not sure about taxi drivers that, you know, we paid them 750. I wouldn't know what that compares to, because we didn't have to ask for proof of their income, what they would typically pay. Obviously, we took into account their expenses in terms of licenses and the cost of the vehicle and insurance. But as far as how long it was expected, it's like with any grant really. We don't, once the grant's been paid, we don't do any follow up to sort of say, how has this fared? We haven't had too many actually phone us back and say, can we have a little payment?
Or was it supposed to be subsistence?
No, it was basically to as a one-off payment to allow them to continue their business to run. So anything in terms of these grants that we're paying out shouldn't actually be used to pay people's wages. It should be used, because there's other methodology for that. So there's things like universal credit, the self-employed income support scheme to cover everyday living expenses. This was a £750k pay that would help towards their car insurance.
Right.
The licence of food repairs, that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you, Chairman.
I can see Robert nodding. Do you want to say anything, Robert?
How much have
you... You can take your mask off and shout at us.
Obviously, it varies vastly how much taxi drivers will actually earn, depending on the amount of hours that they actually put in. Some work more than 37 hours, so 40, 50 hours, and some work short periods of time. But if you think that potentially a taxi driver has a vehicle and which they bought and potentially have had to have a loan for it, typically quite a few of them would pay probably £200 a month loan payments for their vehicle. Mm. So £750 really wouldn't go that far, but would be a help. All the taxi drivers I've come into contact with have been really grateful for the Borough Council for actually receiving something, because obviously in other parts of the country taxi drivers have not had the benefit of this payment. So it's been they've seen this as a form of recognition of the vital role that they've played in the borough, because quite often with buses not running, taxis have been the only form of transport for essential workers, volunteers to be able to get to do their jobs, such as nurses. And also a high proportion of taxi drivers have actually succumbed to COVID because of their close contact with people. So I think it's been more than just the money. I think it's been the recognition of the role that they played during the pandemic that they thank the Borough Council for.
Right, thank you, Robert. Now we are going to go to Mark.
Well, thank you, Chair. just a really question. Are we covering the narrative pages from 6 to 10, or are you going to do a separate presentation on that?
Finish out. Speak up a bit. Speak to me first.
Right.
So I know.
I just wanted to, in terms of the narratives, as we further down on page 6 through to page 10.
No, we haven't got to that yet.
Right.
No, we'll come
to
that in a couple of minutes. Yeah. Okay. Then we're just talking about actually page 4.
Yes.
Because I thought this was the most important piece of this meeting. Let alone that there's a football match on afterwards.
Yes.
But we'll come to what you say earlier.
Thank
in
you.
A few moments. Right, now anybody else got any questions to ask Martin about 5.3? Andrew, you're happy?
No, I'm happy with that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right then. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
And if you feel you've got to contribute, come back to the table.
Okay, we'll do.
Okay.
I don't want you asking twice.
Thank you. we'll go now to 5.4. At the bottom, this is I've asked this question earlier today, and we're going to ask it again today about the Staffordshire Ironman. Is it definitely on?
It is.
It's definitely on.
Yes.
And all the arrangements have been made. Somebody muttered at me today when I mentioned it about being.
So the Ironman event itself, Ironman Give It Us, and the Director of Public Health, thank you, a number of presentations in terms of the COVID secure measures that they're putting in place so that they can hold the event safely. And the security advisory group, including partners chaired by Robert, has been overseeing the running of the Ironman event. So as we speak, the event is still taking place on the 18th of July, irrespective of the government's recent announcements.
Okay then, thank you for that. Now anybody else on page 4? Chris?
Thank you, Chair. Can I just come on the Ironman? Yeah, I have been in touch with Rebecca.
Oh yeah.
Ironman, yeah. About them and asked her if they would please notify all the people taking part not to park their cars in nearby streets or areas on that weekend, because it just caused problems, big problems, especially the crossings. What have you. Some of the residents have asked for codes, and I was told that codes don't work, and I don't know if the members have had experience of codes. I find they do. But anyway, it is definitely going ahead, but with less competitors, I understand, than usual.
Yeah, they're nodding behind you, so.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Okay, then. Thank you. Anyone else there? All right, let's move on. Now we move on to page 6. And you tell me when you want me to stop, Mark.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm on page 6. And I muttered about this today, about it, the writing being so small. I have to. Right. So, all those items on page 6, anybody got any comments or questions to ask? Chris?
Thank you, Chairman. I don't quite really make head or tail of Stafford retail premises occupancy, because it says the top is 88. And it says that it's good high, it's high, so it's good. Now, have you been down the main, down the town?
Yeah,
Bleak is empty. And it isn't the council's fault, so I realise that, because we don't own the premises. But, you know, it's because of a lot of things, COVID, landlords, or what have you, but can we have some actual information on how many shops are actually occupied, how many premises are actually occupied, rather than percentages? Because that, to me, says 88% left, and it doesn't make sense. When you walk down the street and see such a high number of empty properties. So if we can have those, and also the types of properties, I think that would be the types of occupants, whether it be hospitality or whether it be clothing or what have you, you know, shoes.
Right. Okay then. Has anybody else any questions on that page in particular? I don't know whether we should ask this question at this stage, because about the Guildhall Mall, that this comes under that particular area about occupation of buildings. And the reason I brought this in, because I'm not sure that people who live in Barlaston or Millich, a place like that, would get their hands on this newspaper. And I will be honest, I don't buy it, one of my sons does. He buys it so his mum can read the important page.
Who's in die?
Who's gone before him. But this is, and I will mention this actually, Exodus of the town's main shopping centre goes on with two more exits. And Karen and others know, because I mentioned this before, well, I've mentioned about it. I was stopped in the street. The first I knew about problems in the Guildhall was this lady who stopped me in the street and said, all the shops are leaving. And what it turned out, that in actual fact, a number of the shops, I'm told, their leases were up. And so some of them were pulling out at that stage. But as I said earlier today when we were talking in the pre-meeting, that Guildhall Mall is an important thoroughfare for people in the Market Square to go for the buses at the back. And one of the things we must try and make sure is, one, it's kept open, and the other thing, of course, is that we'd like to know, how can we help these developers to bring it back to life? Because otherwise, you know, it's going to be this sitting there as a white elephant. And that's been one of the problems. Yeah, do you want to
so,
go on,
yeah,
Karen?
I'll do it, and then feel free to contribute. So you'll be aware, and hopefully all of you will have received the updates that I sent around to all councillors, and also understood a little bit more about what was happening in Guildhall.
I think we were as taken by surprise as anybody around this table at the pace at which some of this happened. You'll know that the Guildhall changed hands. I think it was completed just after Christmas, so the company that have taken over the Guildhall, Mercia Real Estate, are obviously in the process of reviewing their asset and have taken certain business decisions which are theirs to take in terms of the individual units in the Guildhall. However, since and as soon as we were made aware of the situation, which is something we need to work on with Mercia going forward, obviously that communication piece was not good, we've been in discussion with them, with the individual retailers affected, and also with owners of all the premises in Stafford Town Centre, because obviously our objective, irrespective of whatever role the Guildhall has in the future, here and now, is to work with those businesses that are affected and try and retain as many of them as possible who want to stay and who are able to stay, given what we know about the state of retail. It's a challenging situation in Stafford. And as Councillor Barron's just alluded to, we know we've got a number of vacant premises. So Martine, again, not that she wasn't busy enough anyway, has been working as a sort of liaison point between the owners of the Guildhall, the individual businesses, and our agents and owners of other properties in and around Stafford to do what we can within what we're available, is available to us, to try and retain some of those retailers. In terms of the functioning of the Guildhall as a thoroughfare, I think that's absolutely correct. It's not closing. It's not the intent of the current owners to close it, and also the access to the market is an important thing that we've said that they need to keep open. There is a relationship between the Guildhall and our wider programme around Future High Street Fund, which is quite sensitive commercially, but what I've offered to the chair of the committee, if you would be interested, is a briefing, a briefing over Teams or Zooms for the whole committee, in confidence, so that I can give you more detail on what's actually going on behind that in probably in a few weeks' time, certainly well before your September meeting, so that we're able to share with you informally some of the work that is going on behind the scenes to understand with Mercia Real Estate what the future of the Guildhall looks like and ensure that that makes a positive contribution to Stafford and our vision for change in respect of the whole of the Future High Street Fund process. I think it's also really important that we get to a position as soon as we're able to be able to communicate some of these plans. Our difficulty at the moment is that we're, as we've said before, when we were bringing reports through council and so on, we're in a slightly still in a relatively delicate situation commercially on some of the Future High Street Fund projects. But we're working really hard, and with our partners at the County Council as well, to be able to put out actually some messages about what the future proposals actually are. Because it's really hard to be able to see these types of stories and not be able to show what that future looks like. So that's something that we're working on, to be able to communicate that. But I want to be able to kind of share some of that with the committee beforehand as well in terms of that. So it's a challenging situation. It's a challenging situation for retail nationally, which is why we embarked on the Future High Street Fund work even before COVID. COVID has obviously, I think, exacerbated these issues, and then we've had a set of commercial decisions taken by a shopping centre owner that have played into that as well. I think our role and what we're trying to do is to keep as many of those businesses as we possibly can in Stafford. It's not just the businesses, it's the people working in those businesses.
True.
That's really, really important for us.
Okay, thank you. Chris, you want to say something?
Yes, please, Jeremy.
And then I'll come to Dean.
Spoke to the gentleman at Mercia, because I heard about it, because I spoke to you on the telephone afterwards.
Yeah.
I heard about it on the Saturday morning, because the staff who were affected at the shops were closing had actually put it on social media. And that's how I found out. Contacted George at the Guildhall. He sent me a message back and just said that what bit he knew. What they told me I could do. So I contacted Mercia on Monday or Tuesday. I spoke to Jack about it. They told me that they'd taken over on the 5th of May.
Right, so that's when they finally completed.
Yeah, and they'd taken over on the 5th of May. But what was interesting was he said, if you need to speak to me again, Chris, please ring me back. You've got my number. So the next day, when the statement that was supposed to be coming out that day, by the end of, hadn't come out, the next day, I tried to ring him up. And guess what? He was busy each time I tried on the telephone. So I'm not very impressed at the moment. So I'd be interested to hear what's actually going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Karen.
Right.
Okay.
That's Chris. Dean, you
thank you. Yeah, I think given the offer of keeping us up to date, I think it's really important, particularly this committee, if not other committees as well. Because I'll be assuming that they'll want some of the pie with the development money, won't they? So it is really important that we are informed and we know what's going on, because to play the blinder that they did is not really good, is it?
Okay, anyone else want any comments on this? Right. Okay, now that's page 6. And we move now to page 7. Anybody got any questions on page 7? I'll take Councillor Jones first.
Turn your sign around, then he knows what you are.
It's strange, they're all going to say the mayor. But
it takes
a little while for that to drop off.
It's so long being the mayor.
Yeah, that's right.
I hesitate to ask a question, and I'm concerned about 1.12 in terms of affordable housing. I've got an interest in affordable housing locally, and this talks in terms of supply. And my question relates to the identification of the demand for affordable housing and to the extent that neighbourhood plans that have been developed reflect the requirement for affordable housing in particular localities, and to what extent there is a balance between developers purchasing land with a view to building affordable housing and a local recognition of a need for affordable housing. And I just wanted to have an understanding, and perhaps it's a bigger subject than you'd want to take here tonight, but I'd like to register it as a question, as an issue that perhaps
I have to say, we've got a member of staff here who has sat very quietly, but now it's his turn. Alex? Go and sit where. Okay. I assume that everybody knows who Alex is. All right.
I've seen him in my life.
We've seen him before. Okay. Righto. Off you go, Alex. It's your turn.
So, as a committee will be aware, in terms of affordable housing, there's a policy in the local plan that addresses affordable housing that's supported by an evidence base. And obviously, neighbourhood plans and development come forward above a certain number of houses need to comply with that affordable housing policy. Members may also be aware that when we went out with our issues and options on the new local plan in February last year, that was also supported by a new piece of evidence called the Economic and Housing Development Needs Assessment, and that again identified the affordable housing need that we would need to consider as the new local plan is developed. And there's an interesting and quite detailed table in that that sort of goes through by parish the amount of affordable housing that could be looked at through the new local plan. So in short, it's an issue that we will need to come back to and look in more detail. You're absolutely spot on with that, and we will do with the committee as we continue to progress with the local plan at the appropriate time.
So can I ask Kevin if there are milestones on that work that we could come to this committee for us to review progress?
We're looking to bring a local plan update report in September. That's your meeting in September, so that would be a good opportunity to set out the milestones of what we've achieved so far, and then where we're heading next. So that would then be able to sort of frame and give you an idea of when those more detailed discussions can take place.
Mr. Chairman, I'm coming from the demand side rather than the supply side.
Now, just a minute. You've got that. You've said you're coming from the demand side. How many people want affordable housing?
That's what I understand.
Yeah.
Demand.
Which I think is a housing issue. I'm happy to take the question,
yeah.
Chair.
In a moment. We've got Alex here, and Alex answering the question.
He's talking about something different.
Yeah. But carry on, Alex.
One point.
You'll get your turn in a minute, Jeffrey.
No,
I'll
get that. I'm not going to waste my evening.
So, in terms of demand, then there's a policy in the local plan that ensures that parishes can do parish-based needs assessments to actually then identify what that demand is, and the neighbourhood plan poses an opportunity for that to be done to support as part of the evidence base the neighbourhood plan, but also there's that aspect of the demand that was included within the evidence base.
I'm going to bring it in September
as well.
Okay, thanks for that, Alex. Now, Joe, Jeremy, it's your turn.
Thank you, Chair.
It's a pleasure. You're going to have to swap seats.
No,
Italian football.
No, I'm watching the clock.
Thank you, Chair. Good evening, and good evening to the committee. Two points I wanted to make. One is that with the existing local plan, there was a needs-based assessment which suggested we needed to build 220 affordable houses a year. That is monitored as part of the other scrutiny committee. I think I would encourage members not to look at the quarter by quarter picture, because quite a lot of the schemes taking affordable housing based on what Alex has said will take, you know, tens and twenties, and you know, sometimes you're massively over and sometimes you're massively under. We monitor it within housing, you know, on a quarterly basis. To date, year to date, since the start of the plan in 2011, we built in line with the needs-based assessment of 220. So whilst the figure in the document you're talking about is under the 220, it's marginally under. Arguably, some of the delays we've seen have been down to A, finding building materials, and B, COVID impact. But I'm relatively relaxed that we're on target, and that the pipeline for the next 12 months is looking sensible. There's always a problem in terms of looking further out than the 12 months, because you know, you get nervous palpitations that you're not going to bring on the 220 that we're looking to do so. The second part to the answer, and you will know this from Barlaston, is that if there is unmet demand in local areas, there is the opportunity for parishes to bring forward a needs-based assessment and then to deliver affordable housing themselves in conjunction with partners, which are usually, you know, one of the RP or registered providers. Stafford Royal Homes over the years have delivered housing in Hickson, Swinnerton, and a number of other places, and Nosal, in terms of rural exception sites. That's really to pick up any additional demand that we haven't met in very hyper-local areas, which is what I think you're talking about.
Right, thank you. All right, Alex. All right.
Thanks.
Hang on, Dee wants to ask a question.
It's again on the 1.1.2. I was going to ask what's happening about the deficit, because obviously the intention was 220 and 196. You partly answered it, but what are you doing about it?
There isn't a deficit. I think that's what I said.
There
isn't a deficit. You can't just measure it on a quarter. You look at the, you know, over the whole of the lifetime of the plan. Otherwise, you get yourself into a, you know, you either, you know, make too many, because each year you carry on with a surplus, or you've only got an under score. So it's planned to date, no deficit, no problem.
Okay.
And my second question on that was that I don't see any provision for any social housing.
Can I answer that? That again is the other committee.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm happy to take that question. There is, we can provide you with a split of social housing versus affordable housing, if that is what the chair of this committee would like.
Thank you. Would like. Thank you.
I will answer that.
Okay. Right. Any more questions on seven? Page seven. Brian Cross, and then I'll come to you, Mark.
Yeah, it's just on 113, we've got the happy smiling face and we've achieved our objectives, but we don't see it anymore. We used to publish all the planning applications, results, etc. in the digest. Since COVID, we don't see it anymore. I have mentioned it to Karen and John Holmes, but it's something I'd like to see appear again in the digest, even though it is the online.
In the digest.
Yeah.
There are.
Yeah, we'll get it going again. I've said this before this meeting, but we will get it going again currently.
Yeah. I think we have to accept on occasions that the pandemic has affected lots of things.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that it's something, if we feel we're missing on it, it's something we should draw to attention and hope it gets back to normal. Right, anything? I've got Mark, sorry.
Yeah.
Mark next.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And I realise that we're going through quarter four and there's a little bit of historical in this, but I think it gives us a really good springboard for looking forward. And I know sort of what Martine just said was particularly relevant. And to go forwards, and it's something I'm sort of falling out of the county about, because I don't think they are going forward quick enough. Stafford Borough is ahead of the county as far as I'm concerned at the moment, and I hope it carries on like that. But to go forwards, we've got to get more businesses in, we've got to get business survival, and we've got stronger businesses within the borough. Now, there's one or two things further down the report I'd like to speak to on as well, particularly the rural one. But like Brian, I'm surprised there's a smiley face on planning. And the reason is I haven't got a smiley face because I'm getting lots of stick off people who want to expand projects, want to do planning, this and that. And we haven't seen any figures, but it does feel to me like there's some sort of a lag, sometimes a 3-month lag, in what's happening and how we're sort of going forwards. And I don't know if it's the right forum to ask this question, but are we performing at the moment as we should be performing? And if we're not, what are we doing about it? Sorry, it's a bit of a harsh question, Chair.
Yeah. No, I mean,
do
you want to? Yeah, you answer it.
Yeah. Karen will give you the figures, but the answer is, I think the comfortable answer, if you like, is that we are meeting the government's targets and we're meeting them very, very well. And that's in terms of major planning and the other planning applications. And that is in the face of a massive increase in the number of applications that has come through during the coronavirus, which I can't really fathom why there have been such massive increases in the applications. Because to have an increase in planning applications at a time of when the service is so disrupted with home working and so on has been very trying, I think, for the whole service, and particularly for the senior management. Simple things like being able to see the A3 maps that you couldn't do when you came into the office and so on. So all those things have conspired against, and yet the team is meeting the government targets. Now that's the comfortable answer. The less comfortable answer is that, is the question I keep asking, is that we are getting an awful lot of agreed extensions. And as we come out of coronavirus and the service begins to stabilise itself, I think what we need to do is to try and work towards meeting the 8 and 13 week timetables much more comfortably than we perhaps are at the moment. Having said that, all of that, we have to keep saying some of these agents' applications and applicants' applications are absolutely shoddy beyond belief, and they have to keep going back endlessly. So it sinks one half dozen of the other. It's a major problem for the service, and it's a major problem for every service throughout this country. Every planning and development service is struggling because of the outcome of coronavirus. We're not alone, and I think Carol will say she's very conscious of it. I'm very conscious of it, and I do nonetheless commend the planning staff because they are working so hard to meet the needs of the planning service. Karen, it's up to you now.
Let Mark come
Karen
back.
Yeah.
Comes in. I'm really pleased that you've said what you've said for two reasons. First of all, honesty is great, and it makes us all feel a bit better when we sort of say, well, there's a lot of extensions and everything else. But also what you've said is there's a lot of applications that have come in during COVID. And I've, within my business and talking to other businesses, people are keen to find alternative businesses as they go forwards, different ways of doing things. People want to put barn conversions up and everything, which is a minor thing, but people want to change the business profile. And I think one of the things with planning, and I know it's semi-legal and everything else, but I do think that sometimes we need to possibly have a look at the route, which is, are we asking too much of people, or if someone's putting a shoddy application in, why aren't we charging them for the planner's time to get someone else in to deal with those? And I think it's time to look how we do it for Stafford Borough, and because there's so many planning applications, we could come out of COVID in 2 or 3 years' time thriving, but we can't deal with it. Business can't do with a 6 month lag, 12 month lag.
I think we're very conscious of that and take it all on board. Sorry, Chairman, it's up to you.
Yes, Karen, do you want to come back? I've got two more people ask questions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Francis has summed it up beautifully. I think the latest figures show that we continue on the government's measures to perform well, but I think we can't ignore the context working with them. And I think Mark, you're absolutely right in the sense that for me planning is an enabling service. It has its requirements, has its legal requirements, but effectively it's a key tool for us in terms of our recovery strategy. However, what I would say is in terms of the increase in volume, we're looking at about a third more planning applications leading up to sort of Christmas, early part of this year, than we would normally be doing, which is quite astonishing in the circumstances. And my office's caseloads are, in some cases, almost double what they would normally be dealing with. So what we're doing as a management team is not resting on our laurels with that. I don't think we would disagree, and we are having lots of feedback from members around the table. And I know you're under pressure, and I'm sure you're absolutely under pressure from applicants and members of the community. I've been out speaking to individual agents as well to try and get that perspective in terms of where we do well as a planning service and where we've got room for improvement. Because I think if I say we've no room for improvement, I'm not doing my job properly.
You'd get shut down.
Yeah, I would get shut down. So I think it's something we're very, very mindful of. I think we're making sure, and we've been on a recruitment drive recently to bring some additional resources into the team in terms of the capacity, as well as growing our own junior staff that we're only developing. And down to the minutiae of how we're managing it in terms of actually this week we've actually started to bring a number of our staff back into the office at an accelerated rate over and above the rest of the organisation, so that they're able to overcome some of those challenges that working at home has brought them. But we are absolutely not resting on our laurels in terms of performance of the planning service. For the authority, the planning service is on planning applications are of, you know, an area can be a great contention, and I think we need to continue to improve how we communicate and how we move forward. But I would concur in the sense that for me it's a really critical thing to keep improving and get it right as we move into COVID recovery.
Okay, now I've got Andy Harp.
Yeah, I disagree. We've been shoving things under the carpet and moving things, moving pieces of paper around. I've got a validation by one applicant. It hasn't even been validated. It's been in 12 weeks. It's still not been done. I was berated at a parish council meeting only last week. When I went into it, the information has been on somebody's desk since August last year, and nothing's been done about it. You know, this isn't good enough. People are paying money. We've got to act as a business or get something done about it. It's all I'm saying about it. We've got no enforcement officers. There's a pile of work that a mile high will never catch up unless you bring an army in to sort it out, I think. We're that far behind because they'll never get done at the speed of we're doing it. And it's wrong. I mean, people are paying money to have planning done. It's up to us to get something moving. We're setting about. Even architects are answering about it. So it's no setting down saying about, we know the situation there, nothing's been done, it's been carried on and carried on. It's about time somebody did something about it. I can't keep facing these people. I've got those many enforcement things just around a small area of 2 miles around me. It's incredible. Nobody's been anywhere near it. Can't do it because there's nobody to do it. And there's people knocking houses down and then building them. And I don't know if that's a serious issue or not. No, nothing can be done about it.
I think, Chair, can I just say, I think Andrew needs to send any details through to Karen to look at, because
I have to stand up
in their defence. They are dealing with agents as complaints come in.
Yeah, and maybe send it to your fellow councillor.
I dare
tell about half of it.
No, right, now hang on a second. I've got Phil, and you want to come in as well in a moment then. Okay, Phil.
I think mine really follows on from Andrew's. What are the staffing levels like in the planning department? Are all the posts filled, and what's being done to fill any vacancies?
So in terms of the two sides, but on the development management side, as of now, we are fully staffed, but that's the first time in quite a while. It's a very challenging recruitment market. We do use agency staff to supplement that, but as we sit here at the moment, we have actually now got a full complement of planning officer staff in development management. The challenge is often keeping hold of staff. It's a very competitive market. I think the recruitment challenges that the planning sector faces are not faced by staff of borough alone. We have and are taking part in a piece of work with other planning authorities across Staffordshire to just check what we are paying and making sure that we're competitive. Enforcement is a different picture, and I think Councillor Park's absolutely right in terms of the capacity issues that we're facing there. So at the moment, we are recruiting into a vacancy for a full-time enforcement officer. I have a new temporary member of staff who's starting on Monday, and to support Eddie Smith, who's obviously Eddie Smith. Sorry.
Oh,
that's my old boss in Manchester.
Freudian.
You'd be laughing at that, my old boss. To support Eddie in terms of moving that forward. I think we constantly, to be fair, we've spent a lot of time with the Cabinet running through this in terms of being challenged. Do we have enough capacity? Do we have enough capacity in terms of people? I think we still believe that we would do, providing we were able to fully staff it. Our issue is around getting the right staff and getting fully qualified staff. I think we do use agency staff, and that's constantly under review. The validation issue, particularly at the moment, is my focus of attention in terms of putting some additional capacity or actually bringing some colleagues from the parts of the council to help us move that backlog. But it's a real challenge for us. But we're in a better place certainly now than we were even 3 and certainly 6 months ago.
Okay, all right.
The problem that I find with, like, every time I go out in my area, I find somebody's doing something that they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, well, that's trouble with
the
village.
I know.
I never said
that. Well, I mean, we please that, and the serious part about
it's
this is that
though.
these things happen, and you have to tell the officers.
They did, yeah.
And then you expect a feedback from them.
Well, that's another issue.
Yeah.
So we'll go down that one.
And I've put a circle round the happy face at the moment.
Yeah.
Right, Brian Cross.
Does it have to be a planning officer to do enforcement? Can't enforcement be done by our other departments within the... Like Rob's people do enforcement. Does it have to be a planning person to do enforcement on planning?
I don't know. I think we've got two people in the room who could possibly give that answer. Karen's one of them, and I think Robert is now being looked at to say what do you think.
Behind his mask.
Right. Now, I think. Let's put it this way. I'm not here to be political, and that's a certain fact. But I do accept that the staff are under some pressure. They are under some pressure, but then, if a councillor writes in and draws their attention, then the courtesy is the councillor should be told what's going on. That's one of the things that came out of the meeting this morning, is that I didn't like being approached in the street by somebody, and said, "What's going on?" And I mean, this is it. We do need to have a method of telling the officers we've got that somebody's given us a problem, and the officers coming back and telling us the reason why and can they do something about it. So, Karen first.
Can I just say, one of the things that may be helpful to members if you're getting complaints and so on and so forth is, I don't know if any of you know Victoria Barraclough. Vicky Barraclough, who works with me.
Yeah.
Vicky's role's recently been changed, and Vicky is working with me to focus on managing and responding to complaints and inquiries, so that to ensure that they don't fall between the gaps, really, because I think some of that's been happening. So I would urge you, obviously contact me, no problem with that, but I'd urge members around the table and others to ensure that Vicky is aware of it, so that she can work with me and make sure that that's followed up. Myself and the Chief Executive sit down with her on a monthly basis now to review all of the queries, complaints, inquiries and councillor inquiries that are coming in, because we just need to make sure that we're helping you as much as we possibly can in terms of being able to field those complaints and give us. So just wanted to just flag that up with members.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got Chris Barron again.
Thank you, Chairman. Yeah, I would just like to say that I am extremely disappointed by the response of the planning team. I have written over the last 4 months. I have sent several emails. I have copied other people into it to the point where I actually copied Tim Kay into it. At one point, I spoke to him after the last council meeting. And I still haven't had a reply. I am still waiting for a response.
Right, well, I'm sure that at least two people have noted it down.
Yeah, I've spoken to one of the planning officers who was actually dealing with it twice on the telephone.
Right. Okay, now Mark.
Yeah, just a very quick one, Chair. And I think it's what's just been said by Karen is incredibly important, because I've sent stuff to Michelle, I've sent stuff to John Holmes and whoever else. If we've got, as councillors, and it's not just for this committee, it needs the whole council telling, if we've got a portal where we can actually say we've got a problem, and I've got the same with validation, it's been 10 weeks, 12 weeks, 15 weeks, and if you're running a business or an agricultural business, you can't wait till 15 weeks, because then it's picking winter when you want the building. So, apologies for the agricultural language.
It's all right, I understand that.
So if we've got someone, which is Victoria, and the rest of the council's told that, and two things. First of all, we can get the information to her, but more importantly, even if it's this is the stage it's at, just as simple as that, and it's because of the problems, we expect it to be 12 weeks or 2 weeks, whatever. And that's the important thing, is that communication with councillors. And what it means is that people like Andy and Chris don't get really ratty with you at meetings because they get the questions answered.
Right, okay, thank you for that. That was page 7. Right, we'll move to page 8. I think Dee wants to ask a question on page 8.
1.2.7 with regard to consulting and identifying traveller and gypsy sites. Where are we with that? Because that seems to have been knocking around for a long time, even though I haven't been on this committee, I'm aware of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Am I okay to answer, Chair?
Yeah, come on.
So there's two elements to this, really. I'll talk about the site first, and then Alex will give an update on the needs assessment. It is a challenging one, so our committee are aware that for some time now we've been looking to identify a site for gypsy and traveller provision. We have some resources in our budget to do so, and I have delegated authority to move that forward. It's incredibly challenging to find the right site. Every time we talk about this in committee, I would urge members to come forward if they are aware of any. The responsibility for this now sits with Michelle Smith's team. We've actually got an officer who is proactively searching for sites and is also monitoring sites that are coming up for auction, for sale and so on. What we then need to do is an assessment of the suitability of those sites. And we have looked at a number over the last 18 months. The challenge is trying to find something that's suitable in terms of a whole raft of issues, not just planning, but in terms of accessibility, sustainability, proximity to facilities, and so on and so forth. And that would also meet the Homes England criteria, because for us moving forward, getting Homes England support to ensure that we build a really high quality facility is very, very important. So we continue to look, we continue to reach out to partners to identify if land becomes available, we continue to explore, but we're trying to move as quickly as possible to do it, because we're very well aware that even though we're bringing forward new pitches at Glover Street at the moment, we still will have a requirement. So it is absolutely something that we're trying to prioritise. But again, I think we've said this before, if members here, elsewhere, become aware of sites that they could potentially suitable, and I know it's challenging to make us aware so that we can run them through that process and understand whether they're suitable.
They're already there.
And move quickly.
Right, okay, all right. Phil?
1.2.5. As more and more electric cars are being purchased, and the government are encouraging people to buy electric cars, how are the installation charging points progressing within the borough, and what is the timescale for doing this?
Chairman, can I say very well and Robert will answer?
Thank you, Chairman. I think I've got to be very careful of what I actually say, because I think I gave a written response to Councillor Leeson very, very recently, so he's probably reading the answer that I've already given him to this question.
We're sharing it now with us.
But for the benefit of the rest of the committee, obviously, the provision of electric charging points isn't just the responsibility of Stafford Borough Council. It is a responsibility of all agencies, be it the County Council for on-street car parking, for supermarkets, for their customers, for railway stations, for the National Health Service, at hospitals. So you also have to ask, what are they doing? So it shouldn't always be, what are the Borough Council doing, what is anybody else doing? Additionally, I would also say, as individuals, what are individuals doing to put electric charging points in their own properties? Because you can retrofit your own property and power them in your own home. So we have to be careful that people always say, what are the council doing? What are the council doing? Where it's a number of people need to determine what's actually happening. As regards electric charging points generally, I think that Karen and Alex are looking at asking for major developers to provide electric charging points in new build. But let's come to the specific question about what are we doing with our car parks. First of all, obviously we've already got a grant from central government in conjunction with Stoke-on-Trent City Council and Newcastle Borough Council to put in some electric charging points for taxis. But what we'll be able to do is double side them, so half will be for taxis and half will be for the general public, and they will be fast charging points. Council Leeson will be pleased to know that we've looked at three sites in the borough. One of them is Crown Street, the other is Wilkinson's car park, and the third is outside these council buildings on South Wards. So we'll be looking within this financial year, and hopefully before Christmas, to have installed those electric charging points, and there'll be at least 12 electric charging points as a part of that scheme. Secondly, we're looking at our existing charging points that we've got in the borough, which are what we call slow charging points. And we're looking potentially in the next two or three months, I think I'm due to sign the contract next week, for those to be upgraded from slow to rapid charging points. And finally, the government at the end of last year approached what we call unitary or higher tier authorities, such as the County Council, regarding grants available to assist with residents to provide electric charging points. Unfortunately, the County Council didn't actually bid for any monies for this, and neither did a lot of other County Councils and unitary authorities. So they've actually opened the bidding up to district councils to look at potentially providing electric charging points on our public car parks where they are close to residential developments. We have worked up a bid with a company, and the company have actually given us a 5A star for our bid, which we're now submitting to government, which will look at providing additional rapid charging points on car parks which are close to residential developments. We are looking, without giving you too much detail, at providing a charging hub on Doxy, because obviously that's close to the houses on Doxy Road, will also benefit residents, on Christchurch in Stone, but also looking at other car parks which are close to residential developments. So potentially the jail would be one, because they're very close to houses on around the jail, and also looking at the possibility of further charging points on Tenterbanks car park. So there's a lot that's going to happen, and I think all of a sudden councils are doing a lot more, not just the Borough Council, because of the speed of demand. I think it's only 1% of people in the country who have already gone to electric cars will actually say they'll revert back because they're happy with cars. But the biggest obstacle for people actually looking to have electric cars is that they say that the problem is the accessibility of charging points. And they're correct in that.
Yeah, look down, Robert. Okay, well, thank you for that. There's a question I want to ask you. Having seen it going on in another area, can the general public tap into the taxi one?
Yes. What I'm saying is, virtually what we would do is create a hub. One side will be the taxis, but whilst we're at it, we virtually provide on the other side for the general public. So we're using the infrastructure that we get from the grants for taxis to provide a facility for non-taxi users.
Right. And there also seems to be some people out there who think, in actual fact, they can get this, they can get it free. The electric is free.
No. and that leads to the other issue. It's been about really which company do you go with to get the electric charging? Because if you go with one company, you get an account with them. If you go to a different town, you might find you haven't got, it's a different company. So it's a bit like the Betamax, VHS, getting the right company in place. The government is trying to work on the basis that you have interchangeable accounts, but we're waiting for the government to force these companies down that line.
Right,
thank
you. Right. Mark?
Sorry.
Do you want to speak?
Chairman, please.
Yeah, you may speak now then.
Okay then. So, just get it correct, you're going to charge for charge.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry.
You also,
in a minute,
on
Andy.
Public car
yeah,
parks,
yeah,
you also charge for car parking space.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you. It's Andy now.
What are you going to do when you've got hydrogen?
Hopefully I'll be retired by that time.
all Japanese manufacturers are stopping electric and going to hydrogen.
Well, I think that's a good many years in advance.
Well, I don't know. Land Rover are doing it with the new Land Rover. They're not developing any more electric cars. They're all doing hydrogen cars.
Chastised Mark for interrupting.
Yeah.
Same goes for you. You ought to know better. Right. Now hang on a second. You've thrown me off. Are you finished? You're finished. You're all right.
Yeah, no.
I won't let them interrupt
the day,
you. You're finished.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark, you put your hand up, and followed by you.
This is a more serious one.
Football.
And I do agree with what Andy said about hydrogen, but I don't think it's quite so much for cars, but it's more about heavy goods and tractors. JCB have got a digger which is electric, which is fantastic. It works brilliantly until 10 o'clock, and then it runs out of charge. But with hydrogen, and I would suggest that it's two years away rather than
not for cars, it's virtually.
No, but hydrogen is something that's important. And then we go on to the fact that within our local plan as we go forward, should we be looking at large-scale electricity production in terms of possibly more, I'd say, turbines or solar farms? Because without the electricity, we aren't going to get the hydrogen or the electric cars.
Right, thank you. Chris?
Yeah, thank you, Chad. Mark's just said it, really, because we keep threatening to cut our electricity off through the channel.
Right. Oh yes, I remember that.
Yeah.
Right, Dean.
It was just a point really, but it's a bit of chicken and an egg, because if we haven't got the charging points, people won't buy the cars,
yeah.
And they won't buy the cars because there isn't a charging point. So we've
yeah.
got to build the infrastructure, which has been a major problem in this country for years, because we don't build the infrastructure before we plan something that needs the infrastructure to work.
Right, okay.
I'm just worried, Chairman, now I've got to retire within the next 2 years.
Take it early.
I don't want to embarrass him at all. But he and I must say that Robert Simpson and I go back a long, long way. So I do know how old you are.
He's a year younger than me, he's 57.
Right, okay. Now, let's back to being a bit serious. And somebody has said, can I say this to you? If you go in, don't rush, because what's important is that we'll be happening
cold,
in 2 hours. You're going cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's strange, actual fact. It's quite warm at this end.
Yeah,
anyway, what we're going to do, we'll get back to being serious. Back to being serious for a moment. I'm on page 8. I'm going to go to page 9. Anybody got any queries? Dee is asking a question on page 9.
You're not a football fan, is you? No, but I'll be on the shape board. 1.3.4,
Development Lifelong Learning. What do you mean by lifelong learning? Oh, I mean, I know what I mean, but what does this refer to? Yeah, so this is one of the objectives that's been taken from our economic growth strategy, so it would be just prior to COVID. And I think it really is what it says on the tin. It's about learning opportunities at every stage of life, be that early years and young people, but also those that are older and maybe changing occupations and so on and so forth. And it's quite pertinent in the context of COVID particularly. We've mentioned some activity here around redundancy task force, but the work that we're doing around this objective is actually broader than that. We are working, for example, with University of Wolverhampton, who are trying to bring forward a scheme called Learning Town for Stafford, which is trying to kind of create connections between learning providers, community groups and businesses to ensure that it's not just about learning for learning's sake, it's ensuring that the needs of businesses, the needs of individuals are being met
to meet what the demands are in our economy, really. So this objective is there to say that whilst we as a borough council don't have a direct role in skills provision, and a lot of responsibility for that sits with the county council, what we're about is advocating for our communities and our businesses and making sure that learning provision from cradle to grave effectively meets both the demands of individuals and our economy to put us in the best possible position kind of going forward.
Yeah.
That's what we've got in our heads, I think, when we were putting that together.
Because one of the biggest barriers is cost, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go on and do a degree or a master's, even as a part-time student, with the, now with the Open University, it's so expensive that it puts it out of a lot of people's reaches.
And I think that's part of it. I mean, some of the work that we're doing, I'm probably dying to come in a minute, around how we're using our additional restrictions grant, for example, it's not just been about direct business support, but we took a report through Cabinet that's enabling us to invest some of that in apprenticeship provision, in supporting companies as well in terms of providing them the resources to train their staff, because the costs are expensive whichever way we look. And I think part of it is about thinking creatively about how we can support people to access those learnings in different ways, how we can work with our providers. We've got some, you know, some really good providers within Stafford, some really good businesses, but it's about knitting together all of that. And for me, it's understanding where we as the Borough Council and the resources we have can best play into that to kind of help with that objective.
Right, okay. Phil?
1.32. It says that the draft visitor economy recovery plan has been produced for consideration. When is this going to be implemented? I mean, what we need to do is to cash in on the staycation. You know, it's people are looking at visiting places within the UK rather than travelling abroad. When's it going to be implemented? When can we cash in on it?
Some of it's happening right now. So some of the work that we've done around visitor economy has informed how we've given those grants out. So some of the work that our team's talking about earlier in terms of how we're trying to target companies that haven't been eligible for mandatory grants to support that. In terms of moving forwards, it's absolutely key that we capitalise on it. So we're looking at both how some of our infrastructure for that works. So working with the county council to look at how Destination Staffordshire works in terms of destination management partnership, working with our individual businesses in Visit Stafford. You know, we have these partnerships in place while we're getting best out of and enabling our businesses. But also looking at individual opportunities, for example, traditionally IMR would be a good one, but we've got Commonwealth Games coming up. And surely those are big opportunities. And the staycation market is huge, and I think for us moving forward, and certainly from our team moving forward, as well as everything else she's doing, this and the rural economy rise to the top of her list in terms of picking up all those relationships that we've developed and understanding what we can do to support those moving forward. So the economy recovery plan bit is the bit that we're implementing through our grant funding regime that we've put in place now, but there's much more that we can and should be doing around that.
Right, fair enough. Mark?
Yeah, I'll be
sorry, swift. Just a moment, Francis. Mark's got a question.
Yeah, I'll be fairly swift, Chair. It's really 133, which you just mentioned, is rural economy.
Yeah.
But also, I'd like to link that into 141. And the reason is that in terms of the rural economy, in terms of people living in the rural areas, two things have come out of COVID for me that are really sort of quite surprising. First of all, people don't want to live in built up areas so much now. They want to live where the space where they can go for walks, they can do all the things that they've been sort of unable to do for a year or so. So I think that in terms of the local plan, we should just be looking to make sure that we've covered all the bases. And one of the things that, and I think I've said before to Francis, farms that are redundant are not classed as brownfield sites. They can't be classed as brownfield sites. But we've got some big areas, 2 or 3 acres at a time, where we could be putting some nice, sensible housing in and making the rural areas live again so that people are living there. And then the services, the shops, the pubs, the churches we're losing have a chance to thrive in the future. and that needs to, I think, needs to go into the local plan. And the second one is that we also need to pick up the fact that, and it is being done by BT, they're doing quite a good job, we need to ensure that those areas have got at least fibre to premise, they've also got a faster broadband, 5G. Because, again, if we're going to start using robots and agricultural production and that sort of thing, and look after electric cars and stuff like that, we've got to have the infrastructure as well. So I think the rural areas, and we are a rural county and a rural borough, we should be putting a little bit more emphasis on the rural offer. Thank you, Chair.
Right, thank you. Right, okay.
Are you responding? Or
yes. Yeah, Francis.
Can I come back on the visitor economy and on what Mark said? Well, Mark and I speak as one on rural issues and rural economic policy. I would just add that because of coronavirus, more and more people are working from home. We have a very strong, not untypical key village policy, i.e. everything in the rural area that's to do with business must go into particular villages and can't go into anywhere else. Well, what's happening is that people are actually working from home, and we're going to find that the whole pattern of work for those who operate from rural areas is going to change. Because they're working from home, they're going to be looking for somewhere to go and have a cup of coffee or to go and do a little bit of shopping. So we do, in my opinion, need to look at the key village policy. It's something I talk to Alex and others about all the time. In terms of the visitor economy, we are working towards a visitor economy strategy. So there's a lot of stuff about the recovery plan and what we're doing, but we really do need a complete strategy. It is a very, very big business in this borough that's been so overlooked by the local authority as sort of thing that doesn't really apply to us. And we forget, not only do we have the big attractions like the showground, Sandon,
Trenton,
and all the rest, in the borough and Shugborough, but we have numbers and numbers of smaller businesses, including the hotels and the restaurants and so on. And we very much need a strategy. It's all been put on hold because of coronavirus, but it will come. And I hope that you'll participate in it because it's so important.
Right, thank you. Right.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question on 5.2 about the feasibility study. When will we get that?
For Stafford Brooks?
Yes.
Okay, so I think we've had the draft of the feasibility study coming through, and it was very positive. So we're working in partnership with Staffordshire Wildlife Trust to progress the bid to the next stage. And we're hoping, I think it's September, I'm looking at Alex now, but I think it's September when we'll get the next sort of update on whether we've been successful in securing that Highways England money, particularly to get the Stafford Brooks project moving forward, and I'm happy then potentially to bring Ruth into this committee once we're a bit more certain as to what that looks like in terms of how that project's developing.
But when will we see the report? That's the for a number of us sitting round here, this table, the Brooks are important.
Yeah.
The Brooks are important. I mean, you talk to anybody that represents Coton Fields in the past, in the future, the biggest problem there is the flooding, and it's all to do with the Brooks. And of course, we're now talking about things going on topside of Parkside. And it's quite an important project, this, that we do need it to be, for us to see what in actual fact is being proposed.
Definitely, but I think I want to do that when I've got more confidence we've got the funding behind it, and so I think that's when we're looking at in terms of that decision by September, then we can come back to committee with details of the project.
Yeah.
It would be my recommendation.
Okay. Anyone else on that page? Page 9. We move over to page 10. And I'll say nothing. Page 10.
Yes, page 10, Chair.
Right.
Can the officers please advise whether they have changed the route again? Because I understand that HS2 is supposed to be coming through a stopping at Stafford Station. And I am aware of somebody who's trying to sell their house. And because of the possible impact of HS2 going past the bottom of their garden, they're stopping and selling the house. They've lost 5 buyers.
Chairman, it's
the
compatible trains.
Chairman, if I could answer, obviously,
right,
the personnel got the orders sent and they fixed the route and it hasn't changed.
So, coming into Stafford, can I just ask, Chairman, coming into Stafford,
there'll be.
I think
from south.
You might be asking two different questions there. I think you might be asking whether trains from HS2 are actually going to stop at Stafford Station.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yes,
there's always been an indication
be
that at least 2 trains an hour would be
two
stopping
hour,
at Stafford Station.
Yeah.
Would come off at Stafford Station. And that's still the indication that we've been given.
Okay. Mark?
Can I give you some clarification, Chair?
Sorry?
Some clarification on it. At Handsacre, at Litchfield, there'll be a branch line that comes off,
yeah.
And that goes joins up with the West Coast Main Line, which comes through Stafford. But what that will allow is classic compatible, which aren't the full high speed trains, they're the slower version, to go through Stafford.
But
those
got to slow down to go to Stafford.
Yes, and those are the trains that will be servicing Stafford.
Right, okay, thank you.
Right,
we've finished page 10. We're now going on to page 11, which is the report, the business planning report. And this is the bit where I have to stand up in the council and tell the story.
Yeah.
So unless you've got some serious comments to make about this, any that you want to change, I'm going to call the pages because the officers have said, no, you can't change it. Okay, so here we go. Page 11. Any comments on that?
Nope.
No. Page 12.
No.
And page 13. This is just a matter of what we were saying at the council. Right? Okay, now we turn over to the work programme. And I want to remind you of something. I said this very early when I became the chairman. The first, it's 3.1. All right. The member-led overview and scrutiny process is developing a work programme for the members of the committee to own. It is for us to say to the officers, we want this particular item referred to the committee. So the first thing I'm going to do is to turn to page, let Andrew do the page reading, and then I'll tell you what I've said. I'm about to say. Go on, Andrew.
Well,
you've got page 14.
Certainly, Chairman. Well, I mean, the crux of the work programme is on page 16, Chair, in the appendix. And the next meeting is due on the 7th of September.
Right. Now, on the 7th of September, we've already had a comment made about an item being brought into the 7th of September. And there is another thing that I have muttered about today. And that is this 106, the 106 money, the section 106 agreement update. Now, that was brought to this committee and another committee by Councillor McEwen. And I do feel that there's a lot of councillors who don't understand what the agreements are. And we do need it to be made public within the council what the money is used for, where it comes from, and what has been said recently about where it should be spent. And I do feel that that should also be discussed at our next meeting, which is the 7th of September. And
can I just add to that?
It seems to me that it's something that all members could do with Nave Bank, and I did talk to Karen about the possibility of having a short training session just on section 106 that applies to all members so they understand what it is available for.
Yeah. Okay, I think possibly that's a good idea, that we actually draw in the other, all the members. I mean, one of the comments that was made to me this morning was in actual fact, this comes under the remit of three committees,
yeah,
resources,
yeah,
us and the community. All right, so I do feel that it's something that all members of the council should understand how it works. Right.
We also had Sherman that they could emphasise the difference between that and CIL as well.
Okay.
We don't do CIL.
We don't do it. We could.
We're supposed to be talking to the committee now.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Carry on.
Okay,
Chairman,
thank you.
They scored three goals.
The reference that you made to the request was you're acknowledging my request for the September meeting.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay, all right, so you got that, Andrew?
Yeah.
Okay then, so you've got page 16. Any other comments to be made about the work programme? Over the page you've got on 17, this is the February programme next year. And at the bottom you've got future items. And I do feel, you know, that we do need to start thinking about when these appear in our work programme. All right? Now.
Chair, I was going to ask what are the plans when we're going to be published, because I've been new to the committee. I've had some documents sent me, but there's nothing, so I'm a bit.
You're about the local plan?
Yeah.
Alex, when will the local plan be published?
Shout out.
Yeah, go on.
Dead little simple question, isn't it?
I
think
it'll
be a simple answer.
So we're currently considering the implications of the governance reforms and also work on the evidence base for the local plan in terms of the economy and viability, which has obviously been affected by the COVID pandemic. In the meantime, we have been doing work on the evidence base that we can progress in, certainly considering sites and which sites can be included for as suggestions in the local plan. So we'll be coming back to the all members in due course with a updated timetable and also setting out what we'll be considering.
Right, thank you. Okay then, so that's page 17.
Yeah.
I turn over the page and hang on, Mark's got a question before
we
go.
Just very quickly, I know the football's calling some people. In terms of what Alex has just said, and what I said earlier about things have changed post-COVID, is there a role in this committee just to sort of oversee or whatever sort of some of the ideas that are going forwards or... We're supposed to be economic scrutiny, and in terms of the overview rather than the scrutiny, is there a role for this committee there?
Well, planning chairman is here as well.
Yeah.
So I mean, the point is, there is a role here. Alex will present his local plan to us, and other members are invited, and we go through it.
Yeah.
But as we did last time, Alex took over this area here behind us, and we all sat out there and made comments about things we didn't like, or you know.
Sorry, Chair, to sort of push it a bit further. That's great when it comes to the presentation per se, the big presentation. But is there a role for some of the ideas and the changes that we've heard about tonight of just discussing whether it's on the right track? Because once you've done the big presentation, more difficult to change things.
I thought we were talking earlier about the local plan. What did we say, Andrew?
There'll be a report coming in September.
A report will come in September.
And will that
sorry, Peter, will that sort of give us an impression of the direction of travel?
Let's put it this way. When the report comes, we look at it, and if you've got a query or you've got a comment, we say it there and then.
That's fine.
It has to, I think that's the way it has to work. Francis?
I just wonder if what Mark is thinking of it is in terms of business development, the way that the market's changing, the way that businesses operate is changing, and the opportunities that there are for new techno businesses, whatever there are, that I think this committee might find interesting, perhaps not in September, that might be soon. It's the kind of work that Martine is doing, and perhaps in the new year, it would be worth having a look to see if the committee can contribute to that, and to bring in the amount of people working in rural areas and operating businesses from rural areas. Because there are going to be changes, it's huge.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry, thank you, Chair. That's the reason that.
I'm with you in a minute. All right, now I think there's a point, and I will say this. Let Andrew say his piece first, and then I'll come back.
It's just regarding this, we could do with somebody who's into commercial, big commercial investment ideas from the city and what is coming up country. And what we can develop. It's nice building something if it isn't going to be used. So I think we need to have some idea. We don't know what's going on in big business and investments. And I think we need a company that does specialise in that thing to help us to work this plan and we can see where we're going. So it's saying, well, we're going to put that there. It might not be right for this area, or it might be totally wrong. I mean, commercial investment is a very technical thing these days, and where the money goes, people follow. And whether we want to be high tech, what we need a proper firm or to tell us what we should be looking at.
Right.
And we don't seem to have that.
No, I'm going to ask the question then to Karen and Robert. What are your views on that that's been suggested?
I think there's a couple of elements to it. I think as far as the local plan goes, the local plan is our way in terms of physical development delivering our vision. So we've got a lot of work going on around the evidence base for that. And you're absolutely right, the economy is changing. So one of the things that we need to do is bring that expertise around to help inform how our economy is changing. We've done one go at that, but it was before COVID. And I think what we want to do is to reflect on that. That links to our economic growth strategy as well, because there are lots of other things that we're doing that we need to make sure that we're going in the right direction on. And I think working through this committee to be able to bring key updates on that work at the right point in time, I think what Mark is saying, early enough in a process to be able to get your input, I think is something that we should be looking at. When we come in September, what we'll be talking to you about is broadly speaking, the timetable for the local plan and how we're going to take it forward. Having listened to what we've said today, we can talk to Cabinet colleagues and to Alex about how we break that down into stages, and we can come and have some of those discussions with scrutiny potentially before we get to the sort of end point in that, so that we are sharing with you what we're being, the issues that we're considering and trying to grapple with from a development perspective as we move the local plan forward. And I think that then links into also shaping the work that Martine's doing as well, to making sure in your role as scrutiny that we're focusing on the right things and you've got the confidence behind that. So I think that's something we should look at under the local plan, but more broadly as well, in terms of the work we've discussed already on the rural economy, the visitor economy. As we move forward out of this response phase from COVID and get back to where we were in terms of driving that growth strategy forward, then yeah, there are plenty of opportunities, and I think it's beholden on me to work with Francis, Jeremy, Cabinet and my officers to work out what that looks like, so that we're doing that and bringing that intelligence around the table.
I do believe that the number of councils are talking to commercial companies who deal with very big businesses. Bull Mountain in particular, they have somebody permanently advising them on what development they need in their particular area. Where the money's going to go.
Robert was just saying to me, it's a balance for us, isn't it?
We've got
to get an evidence base that's dispassionate and neutral. We've got to harness your connections, but without compromising our position or compromising any sort of sense of vested interest. So it's just about how we manage that, really, kind of moving forward. You as individuals have got your own networks, your own contacts, your own experiences you want to tap into. We've just got to kind of make sure that's all really carefully balanced as we move the processes forward. And things like the local plan, the various strategies and projects that we're doing, all need that kind of input, really, but in that managed way.
Right, Mark.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make this the last one.
Last thing for me. Fantastic. That's the sort of overview direction I was thinking of, and thank you for listening to me. And just a quick one for Andrew, really. We've got to be really careful with these big companies that they do tend to cut and paste reports and then charge you £400,000.
No, it wasn't something different than that, really.
If Mark is talking about having a window into strategic thinking on some of the things that we've been looking at on a progressive basis, and I fully agree with, I think that's absolutely vital as far as this committee is concerned, because I think these things are progressive, and I think we have an understanding of the stages through which the process is going, and if there's a method of keeping us informed and updating us, then I think that would be very welcome.
Right. Can I share something with you? And maybe you saw the same programme that I did. There was on one of the news channels, and I had to ask my wife to watch carefully what was being put on the about Bond March, the ladies' clothing shop. They showed this picture in when it started. I think it was down in Gloucester Way, where they had this enormous department store, and then the catch of why they were showing this was that their next place of work is an enormous warehouse that was being built, and you couldn't believe how big this thing was, but they said that's where they're going to be working from. They're closing shops, but this business is going to come out of that warehouse. Now, I mean, that's one thing that we've never been happy about in this town, is just having warehouses. And Robert smiles because he probably remembers how far back Prime Point 14 was. And somebody, I'll not tell you who it was, had to say, don't forget about it, any politics involved, you bring Prime Point 14 onto the table now, because we needed it.
What I was saying about that, Wolverhampton, they got some land and they were going to build offices, and they brought in this particular investment company about what they should do with this land. They proposed to build these offices, just straight offices, and they told them a totally different way around with the office building, and they put Prime office building there, and they fill the lot, and they're making a fortune out of it. Wolverhampton City Council is making a fortune out of it at the moment. But that was taking advice from somebody who knew the market. We don't know the market. We aren't.
No, we're not. But I mean, we've got officers who are tapping into it.
Yeah, but it's a totally different field altogether. Far beyond us.
Yeah.
Talking billions.
I apologise, because it's been playing for 20 minutes. I'm going to say this seriously to you. Drive home safely, because the most important business about what goes on rest of this evening does not come into about 9 o'clock. It's about 9 o'clock we start worrying whether our team is winning or losing. So we've come to the end of a very interesting evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you.